This is a Spirit of Truth Radio Network original program.
Siempre Adelante, Spanish for ever forward. When we answer the call to pilgrimage, this must become our mindset, both physically and spiritually. In this episode, my guest and I talk about the beauty of the California Missions and its 800 miles of California history. No lesson of California history would be complete without the discussion of St. Junipero Serra, a Spanish priest that lived to evangelize, but today is so misunderstood. Joining me along the way to discuss the California Missions and St. Junipero Serra is the author of the book, Pilgrimage, Christian Clifford. Christian, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to be here with you. Hey, I got to say thank you to my good friend, Eddie Trask, who introduced us. Eddie is a great friend who is at Catholic Recon, and that's where I actually heard about you and got to be introduced to you by Eddie Trask. So shout out to him. Please check out his channel on YouTube. It's Catholic Recon. Christian, you have an amazing story, and you take it from a historical point of view, and then you add a spiritual component to it. And I really want to get started. And this is a long trip. So it's about 800 miles worth of blisters and broken in boots, I guess.
That's right.
Where do we start?
So I teach at Serra High School in San Mateo, and Junipero Serra, now a saint, canonized in 2015. He is the founder of the California Mission System. And the first one being founded in July 1st, 1769 in San Diego. And he founds the first nine of the 21. His immediate predecessor, Father Lesuen, he will found another nine. And the last founded will be actually during the Mexican period, just during the time of transition between Spain and Mexico at Mission Sonoma, just north of San Francisco, about 40 miles. So I graduated from Serra High School, and I didn't know much about our school's namesake. When I was started teaching in Catholic grammar school, I went on road trips and driving, and I'd pull over and visit the missions to get to know the school's namesake a little more. Mm-hmm. And then when I was hired at Serra, I started to learn about him in earnest, and I eventually drove to all 21 missions. And when I was teaching at Serra, they had a nice, and I'm still a teacher there, but a unit for the freshmen to get to know the school's namesake. So that came about after I graduated, and it's a really good unit. And when I started dating my now wife, we'd go down to Mission Carmel to the shrine there of St. Junipero Serra. Mm-hmm. And we're both school teachers, so we'd begin the year by praying at the at Serra's grave for a good year of teaching. And then fast forward, I wrote a book in 2015, just before the canonization, really for my high school age students, titled St. Junipero Serra, Making Sense of the History and Legacy, because as you're well aware and your listeners, he was somewhat of he's a controversial figure in certain circles. Mm-hmm. So I wrote that using the historical method to help my students make sense of what they're picking up in the claims made about him in social media and so on. So my father-in-law passed away, and I couldn't go to the Philippines with my family for other reasons. I got them on a flight to Manila to go to the funeral, and I stayed behind. And about a day or two into it, I was really bored. And I remembered at a California missions conference, I met these guys called the California Mission Walkers, a few of them. And they're just people, Catholic and non-Catholic, who really enjoy walking between the California missions. And I joined their Facebook group. And a day or two into it, after my being away from my family, I said, oh boy, I saw their Facebook post. And I'm like, you know, that should be able to occupy myself for a while by walking between the California missions while my family's gone. And I'm like, how hard can it be, right? I mean, walking. Mm-hmm. So I actually got into my car and I drove on a Friday after class to Mission Sonoma, the last one built. And I parked my car about 5 o'clock p.m. It was in May, so it was here in California, Northern California. It doesn't get dark until around 8 o'clock that time of year. And boy, lo and behold, I was going to walk about 15 miles that day, or I anticipated it. And by the time I was done, I thought I was going to die. I had horrible blisters. I thought cars were going to knock me off the road. I did have a vest with, you know, so that cars could see me.
The high vis.
Yeah. And, but it didn't look good. I was not prepared for it at all. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, I connected with a lot of the California Mission Walkers and they really, really helped me. So as you're well aware, I did the 800 miles eventually over 45 days it took me, but I did it over like a 2-year period, okay, off and on. And I actually had a map of California and I would kind of pencil in the routes that I took, because I didn't do it. The book that I wrote based on my little blog posts, it's titled Pilgrimage in Search of the Real California Missions. In it, I start at Mission San Diego and I end at Mission Sonoma, just for ease for the writer. But yeah, that's kind of the story behind how I came to end up doing this.
Christian, it's kind of funny because my parish and the two churches in my hometown here in Connecticut, is one is St. Margaret Mary's, the other is St. Francis. And they got connected together and they formed St. Eunice Junipero Parish. So tell me a little bit about this saint.
Great. So yeah, it's kind of interesting how in Connecticut, the heart of, you know, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant Puritan history in our nation's history, there's this a parish named St. Junipero Serra. My guess is that a good number of Hispanics have moved there and are a part of the congregation. Nope. And that's really interesting because...
No, I live in suburbia Connecticut.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's a large... And,
it's interesting.
And I love the Spanish culture. Don't get me... They got great food, everything. I love the Spanish culture, but no, we're predominantly a WASP town.
That's fascinating. I wonder why that is. But St. Junipero Serra was from Mallorca, Spain. It's the largest of the Balearic Islands. It's he's 18th century, young boy. The Franciscans kind of recognized in him his vocation. He recognized it. He was taught by them. He ended up going to university in Palma. And he's a pretty brilliant man. He was the chair of the theology there at the university eventually, and had a pretty good life in terms of academia and his vocation. But there are all these calls for missionaries in New Spain, basically Mexico at the time. And he heeded the call. He really wanted to do more. And he really felt God was calling him to preach the gospel to non-Christians, to natives. And so he goes to Mexico City, where there was a pontifical university for training missionaries in the field. And he basically, for about 20 years, ended up re-evangelizing the natives north of Mexico City, who were without a priest for some time. So they're already Catholic, but they didn't have a priest there 24/7. So he re-evangelizes them. Mm-hmm. And then in the big geopolitical scene of the time, the Jesuits were being suppressed throughout the world. The last place they were actually suppressed was in New Spain, in Baja California, where they already had missions for some time. And the Franciscans took their place when the Jesuits were sent back to Europe by the Pope and the monarchs. So he was there for a short time. I want to say about a year. He founded one mission at Vallecata. And then the viceroy, the king's representative in New Spain, the colonies, said, we want you to go to California, to not Baja California, but what was then called Nueva California or New California, because the Spaniards had been exploring this part of the world before, going back to like the 1560s or 1570s. Mm-hmm. And the first Catholic mass was said here, I want to say like 1620 with the Vizcaino expedition, and they mapped it and all that. And basically they went, the maps and their notes went into archives back in Madrid, I want to say, mm-hmm. or Mexico City or both. And what was happening geopolitically was the Spaniards felt this was their territory, even though there were no Spaniards here. They were fearing the Russians, the British intruding on what was traditionally what they saw as their lands. So the king said, I need you to get up there, military and religious, to plant the flag for Spain. And it was kind of unique because what would happen is, this is known as by historians, is kind of coined the sacred expedition, because you had the military wing and you had the spiritual religious wing led by Junipero Serra. And they were, if the natives were baptized, they automatically became Spanish citizens. So back in St. Petersburg and London, if it ever came up among the emissaries and the ambassadors and so on, they could be like, hey, we got people out there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're in these missions. You know, there's 800 at this mission. There's 500 at this mission. That was kind of the idea. So church and state were really entwined in the Spanish Empire at that time. And that's where I think some of the controversy comes out of, is because, you know, the question is, was St. Junipero Serra, you know, just a working for the government kind of idea, yeah. you know?
Let me ask you a question. Was the word mission, was it more a military mission or was it a spiritual mission?
It was both. But I think that's also the debate, the discussion amongst academics, you know, but it's really both. And Serra is known, he's one of the Americans, you know, or in American history, whose life has just been studied and studied and studied so much. We know so much. And he really saw it as a spiritual mission. Mm-hmm. He didn't see it as a military mission at all, even though he knew he had to work side by side with these guys. But there's so much evidence to show that he spoke out against authority, civic authority, time and time again on behalf of the natives to say, hey, what you're doing here is egregious, or hey, what you're doing here and allowing is anything but Catholic, especially in regards to military personnel in relations to the native women. Mm-hmm. There are incidences of rape and things of that nature. And Serra was very outspoken about that is not good. Okay. How are we going to bring people to Christ when people who supposedly believe in Christ are doing these things?
Right. Right. You know, I had never heard of him before our parish changed its name to it. How common is he in California?
Well, he's the Apostle of California. That's his main moniker. So, mm-hmm. There's Serra High School in San Mateo named after him. Mm-hmm. There is a J. Serra High School in San Juan Capistrano named after him. There used to be, until about 2 years ago, a public high school in San Diego area named after him, but they changed his name because of the whole, during that cancel culture time that came up.
Why is he so canceled?
Because again, the controversy surrounding, was he a arm of the state? Was he an agent of the state or, you know, the church or both? And, that's kind of the heart of that whole discussion and debate. Mm. There's no smoking gun in his hand as to abuse of natives, but he was a man of his time. And he did say that corporal punishment was okay to make a point. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a clash of cultures. The California Indians had different approaches to things, especially, in, I think, in regards to sexuality, and that really clashed with Catholic belief and teaching. And it's a pretty complex piece of history.
Yeah.
And but there's a lot of evidence, so much that is really overwhelming, that he loved the natives and that he really saw them as if they were his own children.
Mm-hmm.
And some people really hate that. They hate that use of the word children. But a spiritual father, you know, he saw them as their spiritual children.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted nothing more than their salvation of their souls. So, yeah, that's kind of at the heart of all that.
So you decided you wanted to do this whole 800-mile trek. How did you come to start this? I mean, you looked at it from a, if I remember correctly, you looked at it from a historical perspective first.
Yeah.
And then added the spiritual component. Take me through that first, you know, some of the history of the missions and how they were set up and formed. And
sure. So the first being in San Diego, the last being in Sonoma, and there's 19 in between. It's important to note that 18 of the 21 are active Catholic parishes still to this day. They will kind of go away during the secularization period of Mexico. But they will come back about the 1890s, 1900s. Actually, before that, Abraham Lincoln, President Buchanan, the Archbishop of San Francisco, Alemany, he will request that the mission lands be returned to the Catholic Church. Lincoln will agree, Buchanan will agree, and slowly but surely, the missions will be returned to the Catholic Church. But it's not their entirety, just the mission church and its immediate surroundings. It's usually about a couple acres. Because remember, when the Spaniards were here, the Franciscans, they owned huge swaths of land. Their area of influence, it's really important to note historically, was only about from Sonoma to San Diego and about 40 to 50 miles inland. So most natives never even came into contact with the Spanish missions. But basically those lands were all in the hands of the Franciscans. Theoretically, the natives, it really will never, because the idea was eventually teach them the Spanish way of life, agriculture, and so on, and then give it back to them. It is true, though, that the missions were like communes, you know, what you created went right back into the community, food and so on. But, you know, you really need to look at the history of each mission separately, because they already have their own little histories, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think we kind of approach it in a monolithic sense, but, you know, there are times when one mission would be having a drought and another one had a surplus of food and they'd help each other out. There's examples of that happening. The reality is, though, that there were, especially after Junipero Serra's death, disease was rampant. And there was a real high death toll among the natives. So there's kind of an overview of the mission history, mm-hmm. why they came, and how they looked, you know. But they're all museums today. They have museums and they're active parishes. I said 18 to 21. Two of them are state parks, Mission La Purisima down near Lompoc, near Vandenberg Air Force Base in Central California. And Mission Sonoma is a California state park as well. Mission Soledad, which is south of San Jose and just south of Monterey, is a museum. And once a month, they hold a mass there. It's like connected to the local Catholic parish, but it's not an active.
How far apart are these missions? Were they set up at a certain increment so that you could get from one point to a next, like within a certain amount of time?
Yeah. I think there's some legends surrounding that, the idea of, you know, one day apart. I think that on a horseback, you could do one day apart. And it's also kind of a legend that Junipero Serra walked everywhere. He did do a lot of walking. When he was at his first night in Mexico, he was walking between Veracruz and the Shrine of Our Lady of Guadalupe, mm-hmm. Just north of Mexico City. And he slept under the stars, and he was bit by probably a spider, a brown recluse. They're kind of known in that part of Mexico. And he had an ulcerated wound off and on for the rest of his life. So, you know, at great physical expense, he was already in his 50s when he came to Mexico. He persevered, let's put it that way, to get the gospel message to the natives. But he didn't walk everywhere. He had a mule. He would walk. He'd take ships. He did a lot of traveling. That's for sure. I'm sorry, your question was what again?
I just wanted to know about, you know, the distance between.
The distance. So the 21 eventually that would be set up, they say it's one day apart, but more like one day by horseback is more, probably more appropriate. It took me a lot longer.
If you're gonna start this, you know, this pilgrimage, and you start down in San Diego, you say?
A lot of people do, yeah.
How do you go, are there places for you to stay along the way?
Yeah, so it's not to be seen like the Santiago de Compostela in Spain and in France, where it's like you have the hostels along the way and so on. It's not set up like that at all. But, you know, the California Mission Walkers, that group I referred to earlier, they're a great group. They have people, you can reach out to them and they can walk with you. Sometimes they put you up in their homes. They're really a great group of people. They did it for me a couple times. I met some great, great, fantastic people. Sometimes they'd walk with me too, keep me company. It's just a great group. I really recommend your listeners to go see the California Mission Walkers. They have a website.
I plan on checking it out myself. So yeah. My friend, Andy Bull over in London has just started, I don't know if Andy started it himself, but he's done so much work to promote it. The London to Walsingham Camino. And he's kind of having the same problem that you're describing here, is there's not those hostels along the way just yet. I mean, it's this even though it's a rebirth of the old way, there's just not those hostels, but there are parishes, I guess, that are taking people in. Is there any of that?
Oh, yeah. I do know of a group out of San Jose that does a Camino between Mission Santa Clara and Mission Carmel. I think they've done it for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
And the Legionnaires of Christ, a couple of the priests there started this, and they have done a great job of having, you know, contacting Catholic parishes to open their doors and to help their group out. But I think it's just a personal thing, like to reach out and to try. I know one Franciscan who was going to do the one of the major pilgrimages from Canterbury to Rome. And it's the one where you literally just walk outside your door and start walking like the ancient pilgrims did, and hope that people are kind and generous along the way to put you up and help you out. And if not, you're sleeping under the stars kind of thing. Yeah. And what happened was COVID hit. So he couldn't do that. And he returned to the States, and he was in Kentucky. That's where he's from.
Yeah.
And I guess he told the story to a parishioner, and they said, "Hey, we work for the airlines. We're going to get you a ticket," because he's a Franciscan. They don't have any personal wealth. And they gave him a ticket to San Diego. And he got off the plane and he walked from San Diego to Mission Sonoma without a penny. Wow. So there are a few nights where he slept under the stars, but there are nights where he was put up in parishes. It really ran the gamut. Yeah, for him. Yeah, I actually picked him up in Sonoma to take him to San Francisco Airport, and we had dinner together and so on. And I ended up writing a story, online story, I think at Catholic Exchange about it. It's really fascinating. So some people stay in five-star hotels, some people one-star hotels, some people in California Mission Walker's homes that they open their doors to them. Yeah, it really runs. There's only two nights where I actually had to sleep under the stars like the friars did, and that was in Central California. The remotest of the missions is Mission San Antonio de Padua, and it is right outside the gates of the largest Army Reserve base west of the Mississippi. It's called Fort Hunter Liggett. And unfortunately, I walked that part during COVID.
Yeah.
And the mission was not open because of COVID. And they have a retreat center there too. I was really hoping to stay at the retreat center, but it was all closed up. So I ended up having to sleep at a campsite in a tent. And I kind of felt like the friars did, I think, like Junipero Serra did, you know, sleeping outside. I could hear it sounded like hundreds of coyotes howling in the middle of the night. Like it sounded like they were right outside my tent. And it was really exciting, actually, because I did feel kind of
connection
with those guys. Yeah,
sure. Yeah, I can see that. Christian, tell me a little bit about what the Knights of Columbus did to help you fulfill this Camino.
Yeah, well, I wish I came up with the idea earlier in my pilgrimage, but it was kind of towards the end where I said, you know what? I'm going to walk for Mission San Antonio de Padua because it is the remotest and it's the smallest of the missions in terms of being a Catholic parish. I think I read somewhere there's like 50 families connected to the mission there. And I ended up getting probably from friends and including Knights, Brother Knights, about $2,000 in that very short time to donate to Mission San Antonio de Padua. And I think I put it out there in an email, and I eventually got a call from the Knights of Columbus about it. And they interviewed me, and they put an article. It wasn't in Columbia Magazine, but in Nightline. I think it's like a weekly or monthly email blast. Yep. Yeah. And I think Catholic News Agency did an article on it. And I don't know, a couple months later, I got a phone call from Spirit Juice, which is a production company. Yep. That is contracted with the Knights. They're out of Chicago, and they do really great work in terms of media productions. And this is during COVID. They came out with a crew of three, and we spent the weekend together, and they were filming me at different areas in my my backyard. I'm right between Mission Dolores in San Francisco and Mission Santa Clara in the South Bay near San Jose. And we went to those locations and they filmed, and it was really great. And they ended up coming up with like a 5-minute video. Yeah, it's promotional video, I guess, on this season. It's called Everyday Heroes. I think they came out 3 seasons, and I was in one of them. It was really exciting, really neat.
Well, you know what, yeah. Spirit Juice, I do want to say that, you know, my producer, Dave Imhoff, who is back, by the way, and I want to welcome him back. He's been away for about a month, but he's just reminded me that Spirit Juice did Into the Breach, which was another outstanding production that the Knights of Columbus has put together. But we were recently at a meeting down in New Haven, and Spirit Juice was there as well, and they put together a nice video of about the evangelization and faith formation that Dave is leading here in Connecticut. So I just wanted to give them a shout out. Going back to that video, I was really amazed at how supportive your wife was and, you know, your son.
Yeah.
You know, how supportive, and I thought it was amazing, you know, the young man that you've raised is really cared how much this meant to you, and that shows how much he loves you because he wanted you to be happy, and that's what I took away from that.
Well, thanks for that. They're my number one cheerleaders. So in my own backyard, I kind of would take a train or a bus to kind of pick up where I left off,
mm-hmm.
return home for the night. But there are times where, you know, I'm in the middle of nowhere and I'm like, hey, I'm going to go from point A to point B. And they'd pick me up and they'd always have a Gatorade for me. And they really were helpful. And I know it kind of chokes me up just thinking about it. That little quote from him in that video. It's just really beautiful what he said. And I really appreciated that because, it took a lot of sacrifice on their part to let me do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Let me ask you a question. How long does it take somebody to do this, to complete this?
Well, I want to say California Mission Walkers go back to like maybe 2013, I want to say.
Yeah.
And this organization, and I was the 49th person to complete it. And that was a couple of years ago. So I want to say like, you know, anywhere between 5 and 10 do the whole thing annually. People do it in bits and pieces, you know. They'll fly home and then kind of come back and pick up where they left off. But not many have done a throughway like the Franciscan that I referred to, just start at point A and finish at the last one. But it really depends on the person. Like when I first started, like I said, I think I did like 10 or 12 miles and I thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
But by the end of it, I like to tell people, oh yeah, I've done marathons before. And then they look at me up and down like, what, you've done marathons? And I'm like, yeah, I've walked them. I think I did 26 miles or more, or 26.2 or more, 3 or 4 times on my walk. And I was moving along there towards the end, big time.
Right. Oh, once you start shedding a few pounds, you know, you start to walk a little faster, right?
That's right.
So if somebody wanted to do this, what's the terrain like? I mean, California's a big state, but is there a...
Yeah.
You know, how does the terrain and where would you, is there a best place to start, best place to finish?
Well, I think ideally it would be, if you have the time, start at Mission San Diego and finish at Mission Sonoma. It's just kind of neat, right? You start at the first one, you end at the last one,
mm-hmm.
even though south to north, it's not necessarily in that order. They didn't like build them for the first one, you know, they built them where it was practical and there's water. A lot of them, burn down, earthquakes, flooding, you name it. The missions that we see today, some of them are like the fifth one built, the sixth one built. I forgot the question.
I'm just curious about the terrain and you know.
Oh yeah, the terrain.
If somebody say my age wanted to do this, you know, I'm
sorry. I appreciate that. I've been teaching a young man all day, so I've got a little brain fry there.
Uh-huh.
So the terrain, you know, it's Mediterranean climate. It's very much like Spain, even though I've not been there. I know that, I'm aware of it. And the Camino de Santiago, I did some research on it, and you're probably doing something pretty similar, rolling hills. After you get over the Pyrenees are not too much higher than the coastal range we have here. So one day I went from sea level to about 2,500 feet. And that was the highest I went. And that's basically what you would do on the Camino. If you're going from southern France
mm-hmm.
to Santiago de Compostela, you're probably going to do the most in a day would be about 2,500 feet. So the terrain for the most part is pretty flat, sometimes rolling hills. Mm-hmm. Another one you do like a zero to probably like 1,200 feet in one day. But yeah, I mean, I think it depends on the individual and what you're, you know, capable of doing. I wouldn't recommend doing what I did, and that is getting my tush off the couch, putting the potato chips down, mm-hmm. and start walking. I'd probably do a little more preparation, mm-hmm. so that it's not overly overwhelming, or maybe a shock to the system.
Sure.
You know, that's what I say in my, right in the beginning of my book, a little disclaimer. It's like, hey, you know, it's unsafe out there. Do what you can to take all precautions. And
what kind of wildlife do you come across? Yeah,
well, I do want to point out that, I'll speak to your point on the wildlife. The coyotes I talked mm-hmm. about, not wildlife, but domesticated, lots of dogs. So you bring a pepper spray, or I had a long stick too, to kind of keep them at bay. Probably the coolest story is, aside from the coyotes, is I came across a longhorn, a cow one day, a bull, and he was taking up the entire pathway. And I just hugged the fence that I was close to, because the other way was a huge ravine. And if I went that way, I would have died or broke some legs. And he just took up the entire path. And he kind of looked at me and walked past me and let me by, like, what are you doing here? And I'm like, well, I don't think you're supposed to be here either. That was pretty cool. That was just south of Mission San Juan Bautista. And I'm alive to talk about it.
I think he got out
of his bunch. Yeah.
You've talked a number of times about Mission Sonoma, and that's, forgive me, I'm a East Coast guy and I've never been to the West Coast. Isn't that some of the most beautiful wine country in California?
It is. Lots of vineyards. Yep. Right. So, it's in the Sonoma Valley, right next to the Napa Valley. Yeah. The two most famous wine growing regions in the United States. Yeah.
So how hard can it be, really?
Well, you know, one of the things I did every day that I finished, I'd enjoy a beer or a glass of wine or a margarita. And I include those in my book too.
Absolutely.
After each segment. Yeah.
You're not just the author of, I think you're an author of like three books, correct?
Four books now.
Okay.
Yeah. So the second one is St. Junipero Serra. And I wrote that for children, like fourth grade age, because in California, that's a part of the curriculum for the state curriculum. And my son recommended that I give it the title, Who Was St. Junipero Serra, because he was in these books called Who Was series, mm-hmm. Who Was George Washington, Who Was, you know, Isaac Newton, et cetera, et cetera. So I kind of use that as the format. But it's a lot of fun because it's historical fiction, and it's through the lens of real life people mm-hmm. Who knew St. Junipero Serra. And it's kind of based on what I know about St. Junipero Serra, what I know about them, like a conversation between them. And it was a lot of fun. And then my third book is about Pablo Talk. It's called Meet Pablo Talk, Indian from the Far Shores of California. And he is fascinating. Pablo Talk, I learned about in researching for my first book, St. Junipero Serra. And there was a PDF from an ethnic studies class of his writings. I never even heard of him. And I'm born and bred California. And he was a mission Indian from San Luis Rey de Francia, which is in current day Oceanside, California. That's where it's located. And just north of San Diego, in northern San Diego County. And he was also between the Spanish period and Mexican period. And as a young boy, went with the pastor, Father Antonio Perry, mm-hmm. who saw the writing on the wall that Mexico is coming and they were going to secularize the missions and so on. and another young boy, Indian boy, named Amamix. And he took him via Mexico City to Rome to study for the priesthood. And this is in the 1820s, 1830s. And this is why Pablo Tok is so fascinating. As a seminarian at the Urban College back in Rome, he wrote the language of his people. So his writings are the earliest from a California Indian, not just a mission Indian, a California Indian.
Wow.
So, and he wrote the history of the Indians from, you know, Southern California. And unfortunately, he never made it to be ordained. He was very close. He took the oath that he would, you know, stick around. He's not going anywhere, and he wants to be ordained. But it kind of reminds us that disease is everywhere. It's not, it doesn't kind of delineate, oh, I'm just going to kill this poor person or this white, this rich person. But it was a reverse of what happened to the natives in this part of the world with disease. Mm-hmm. He went there and he died of disease in Rome. Unfortunately, it doesn't discriminate, right? It doesn't discriminate. So barely anyone knows about him.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's intentional or what, but it seems pretty disingenuous that every California public school student, Catholic school student isn't learning about him, because he sheds a lot of light on this part of history.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very meaningful and important, his what he did in his very short life. And of course, the last book is Pilgrimage. And I try to incorporate a lot of those Catholic, Native American, Mission Indian stories into Pilgrimage in Search of the Real California Missions, because it seems like in all this controversy, debate, and discussion, their voices are almost silent. They're you have to do so much digging. They do exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a conference. I was invited to a conference a few years ago. It's called the Tekakwitha Conference. They're named after, of course, Saint Kateri Tekakwitha, who was canonized a few years ago. And she was Algonquin, a Mohawk. Mm-hmm. And my point is, I went and spoke about Pablo Tok to them, and I don't think I've ever met a group of such devout Catholics in my life than the Native American Catholics who were present at the Tekakwitha conference that I spoke at. They were just wonderful, wonderful Catholic people.
Christian, isn't that what's really beautiful about our faith? Is that, you know, you have the Spanish missions that are coming in, and they bring the faith to the existing culture.
Yeah.
And it transforms it. It raises it up. It's and beautifies it even more.
I know. But that seems to be somewhat passe, somewhat dangerous in certain circles, and they don't want to hear it. It's like, you know, evangelizing is central to our faith.
Yeah.
But, you know, some people, you know, don't bring it to the public square. Don't talk about it. And that's why the Knights do a great job on trying to defend that. And as a not only a religious liberty,
mm-hmm.
but something that is very important for the world to get better.
Absolutely. Christian, tell me a little bit about the spiritual aspect of your journey along the way that you experienced as you were traveling.
Yeah. So every day I would walk, I'd always begin with praying the rosary.
Mm-hmm.
And another very important spiritual element is I didn't do it first. It's usually a first thing you do is get a blessing before you travel. It's probably a third into the way of my pilgrimage that I got a blessing is at Mission San Rafael in Marin County by the priest. That's always a very important thing to do as a pilgrim. And I put it out there for prayers. I think one of the greatest spiritual moments I had was in the San Fernando Valley, in the LA, greater LA area, or metro LA area. I finished my walk and I was at Mission San Fernando de Rey de España. And I walked into the mission church and there was a baptism occurring. And it was for, I want to say, five people, a young baby, a little boy, and I believe there was a teenager and an adult, or a couple of adults being baptized in the Catholic faith. And I was way in the back and I was just going to say a little prayer of gratitude for finishing that segment. And it was a really powerful moment, you know, like what you were saying about, wow, we're a part of something so big. And here I am in a church that was a mission church founded by the Spaniards, and that faith has been brought generation after generation. And that was a really beautiful moment to me. I think God was really kind of reminding me of just how grateful I should be, I guess, to be such a part of something so beautiful. Yeah.
Was there a growth, a spiritual growth for you? I mean, was there something that just profound that happened?
I wouldn't say off the top of my head profound. I think it's helped me be a better teacher in terms of sharing the story of St. Junipero Serra. I forget why it came up today, but I think I made a reference. So about the hierarchy of truths, I was talking to the kids about that today in the Catholic Church, because we just got over the, in our church history class, the Christological controversies, and how in terms of pious devotion, hey, does everyone need to do 800-mile pilgrimage to call themselves a good Catholic? And of course, the kids are like, no, of course you don't. They're juniors, right? And they're like, no, you don't, of course. But can it help? Yes, yes, it can. It's a good thing. So it can really transform a person, though. And it helped me be patient, because walking from one mission to the other, oftentimes alone, really gives you a lot of time to reflect upon your life, your relationship with others, and your relationship with God. And I was really grateful for that time that my family was able to give to me. A little side note, I did walk with my son, who was about, I think at the time, 12 years old, and we walked about 8 or 10 miles together, and that was a lot. That was really special. That was down in Central California.
That's amazing. And if you watch the video, and I will put it in the show notes, a link to that video that we've talked about, your son says you've become a better dad. And, you know, and your wife says you're a better husband because of doing this. God bless him. God bless you. And we're starting to kind of run out of time here, but I'd like to ask you, St. Junipero Serra, what can we take away from his life today? What benefits would society get if we really followed his teachings?
Yeah, well, Pope Francis, some argue, chose to canonize him to remind the United States that its history is not just the history of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, Puritans, pilgrims, that whole history. That is a part, but also you have French Catholics, you have Spanish Catholics, and they need to be a part of the American narrative because they're very significant. And Junipero Serra was pretty single-minded in the sense of sharing the gospel with others. And he's a powerful witness to that. He didn't let power get in the way. The references I made earlier to, like, hey, some saying, you religious people in the public square, be quiet, you know, keep it to your house of worship or what have you, that no, we should be able to speak freely and openly, because that's what Christ commands. He compels us to Do it lovingly and invitationally and not forcefully. And he did all those things. He was peaceful. He was loving. And he was able to, he didn't cower from the people of power who wanted it their way, civically, politically or militarily. So yeah, we have a lot to learn from him. And his writings are available online. So you can just look up, I think, the Hathi Trust, they have them downloaded or uploaded because they were translated from the Spanish into English in the 1950s by the American Franciscan Historical Society or some group like that. And they're readily available online. He is a great holy man who was pretty zealous. He was pretty tough on himself, you know. But yeah, he was pretty single-minded in his purpose, and that was to spread Christ's message to all those he encountered.
How old was he when he passed?
He was 70 years old.
So he had 20-odd years spreading the gospel, and you know, just in the missions, right?
Yes, and he was baptized just hours after his birth because they thought he was going to die. He was sickly, a little baby, and look what God had planned for him. Yeah. He ended up living 70 years. He heeded the call to a vocation of the priesthood. He, at great expense, traveled far and wide to, and oftentimes at great physical pain, to bring the gospel message. So we can learn his saying. It comes from a letter from Cadiz, Spain, to his parents before he actually got on board a ship to come to Mexico. Siempre adelante, ever forward. I'm pretty sure my parents will, whom I'll never see again, will be cheerleaders for me to bring the gospel to others, even though it means I'm not going to go home again. So siempre adelante, ever forward.
Ever forward. I want to thank you so much for coming. Oh, by the way, interesting fact that I learned from your interview with Eddie Trask. This powerful saint was what? How tall was he?
5 feet, 2 inches. Yeah.
So you don't have to be a big person to do big things in God's.
That's right.
Christian, I want to thank you so much for joining me along the way. Dave Imhoff, glad to have you back, my friend. So for my guest, Christian Clifford, my producer, David Imhoff, I'm Down the Hall Dave, always praying that your troubles be less, your blessings be more, and nothing but happiness come through your door. We'll see you next time.